With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore. Happy to be joined now from the newsroom. We have Salem News reporters Paul Layton and Dustin Luca. Thank you, gentlemen, as always, for helping out. And, Dustin, I'd like to start with you today. The Salem mayor, the special election coming up for mayor of Salem is in only a few days, and maybe you could bring us up to speed on what you're seeing.
Yeah, so thanks for having us, as always. There's a ton going on around Salem right now, especially around the mayoral election, and where now I think we're 4 days away from the actual ballots being cast. There's a lot of just a lot of stuff flying around, allegations of this, concerns about that. So there's a couple. We just finally ran our profiles on the two candidates today in today's paper, and over the next couple of days I'll be completing a couple more stories kind of digging into specific issues in the campaign, one of which is Dominic Pangallo receiving support from Environmental League Massachusetts. This is a political action committee known as a PAC as well, that kind of works a lot in Massachusetts and has been spending quite a amount of money on sending some ad support Dominic Pangallo's way. And I've been hearing about these ads showing up on like the Washington Post and on like TV channels and things like that. So while the two sides are relatively even from what I've been hearing in terms of their spending and everything like that, Dominic has the support of a political action committee, whereas Neil does not. And that's kind of causing some people to, you know, raise some questions about that, kind of the precedent that that represents in a mayoral race, which is kind of the ultimate of local election races. Another one that I'm following on is an email that is at this point 17 years old, but it was an email that candidate Neil Harrington, when he was in his earlier years of town manager in Salisbury, had sent to a freshman mayor, Kim Driscoll, when she had reached out to him basically saying, hey, how can I save some money to kind of balance this horror show of a budget that we're dealing with in 2006? And he ended up sending an email back that had a number of suggestions that in 2023 kind of hit a little differently. Things like, you know, teachers have a lot of summer vacation time, so therefore they don't need as much of that. The fire department has this. And so there was a couple things targeting unions, and now, you know, the teachers union has come out very strong against it. I spoke with Ann Berman, the president, yesterday, and she said she was incredibly offended by it. Haven't heard from the fire department yet, which endorsed Neil in this race, so waiting on that one. And there's a couple of other things we're digging into, but that's kind of where things go. I know we have been in touch with the campaigns. We know where their parties are going to be on Tuesday nights. We're going to be doing the spreadsheet and the coverage that we do every single election season. So just tune in to Dustin Luca SN on Twitter, if you're still using Twitter, or just salemnews.com, any place else. There's going to be all kinds of stuff flying around on Tuesday night.
Well, that's going to make for some fascinating reading, and that is so interesting, Dustin. I appreciate that. And I got to tell anybody who listens to this, if you haven't followed Dustin Luca on Twitter when he's tweeting live, you're missing some really good stuff, I got to tell you. Most entertaining and most informative. So I applaud you for that, Dustin. It's great reading.
Well, nobody wants to read dry tweets about zoning. You got to throw puppy jokes.
And you do. yep. For sure. And in general, as an outsider, it seems to me that these are two very qualified individuals who resonate with a lot of people in the community.
Oh, God, yeah. And so one other little kind of side angle to all this that I'll be touching on. So Environmental League of Massachusetts also put out an ad that had apparently suggested that Manny Cruz was actually endorsing Dominic. And it actually got Manny to come out and say, I'm not endorsing anybody in this race. Both of these people are experienced leaders. They've been leading governments. And he actually said in his statement, either of them would make a fine mayor. So you're seeing, you know, there's people that are in Neil's camp, there are people in Dominic's camp, and then there are some people that are like, you know, whoever we have, we've got one that has 28 years leading cities. We have one that's been literally the second seat in the mayoral leadership process for I don't know how long.
Mm-hmm.
So there's experience on both sides, and what people are kind of looking at is an old Salem versus new Salem kind of comparison.
Okay. Well, I invite readers to pick up the Salem News and follow that. That's for sure. That's been fascinating all along, ever since former Mayor Driscoll became Lieutenant Governor. Let's go over to Paul Layton. And, Paul, once again, great to be talking with you. Great you're home safe and sound, and you had some time off. From your perspective, I know you're just back into it with both feet right now this week, but you know, Mike Cahill seemingly has no opposition, and yet after Paul Guansi dropped out, there has been someone at least taking papers out for the mayor's race.
Yes, thank you, Rick. Good to be with you as always. Yes, a Beverly resident named Philip Venezier took out nomination papers earlier this week to run for mayor, so he becomes the second candidate in the race, along with, of course, Mike Hay, who's been the mayor for the last 10 years. Venezia, I spoke with him the other day. He's never been involved in local politics before, but he just said when Paul Guanci dropped out that he felt like he wanted to have somebody in the race to challenge the incumbent mayor. So he decided to run, and he said his main issue was what he sees, what a lot of people mention in the city, is he sees as overdevelopment and the impact on parking and traffic. So far, he's the only, and of course, he still has to return his papers with the required number of signatures of residents to officially get on the ballot. And there's still a couple months more for other candidates to enter the race. But really, since the news last month that, Paul Guanci dropped out, Guanci is the former city council president and was going to challenge Cahill to set up what would have been one of the, I think, one of the most competitive mayoral races in Beverly in years. But Guanci dropped out when there were these revelations that he had liked these, derogatory tweets, regarding race and gender and immigration and election denial and so forth. And he just dropped out of the race when that came public. So anyway, that's where it stands now. It's Mike Cahill and this Philip Venezia, a newcomer to city politics. Mm-hmm.
As you've traveled around, Paul, do you get a sense that there's a push to get somebody else involved, or is it just kind of everybody just kind of laying back and being passive about this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there is some sense that Cahill's been in office for 10 years. I mean, he's won re-election easily each time, but I think whenever there's an incumbent that's in office for that long, this general sense of, well, is that enough time? Do we need a fresh voice? And I think that's where Paul Guanci, who had long thought of running for mayor and never had, he decided to step in a lot, for that reason, that mm-hmm. Maybe it's time, even independent of anything else going on in the city or any issues. And I think there is a sense of there are a lot of questions about development in the city. All the new apartment buildings that have gone up and ran through the street, there are proposals for downtown Cabot Street, parking and traffic. I think those issues, some people might perceive Cahill as being vulnerable on those issues. So I don't know. I'll be curious. Like I said, there's still a few months left for candidates to take out papers, but also you don't want to wait too long. So mm-hmm. I would think we would hear something soon if somebody else is going to run. I haven't heard specifically of anybody, so we'll mm-hmm. see.
All right, we'll keep tuned to the Salem News as well and follow that. I want to go back to Paul now. To Dustin. And Dustin, we spent the week down at Fort Myers, a wonderful week with Bill Proposky and his family. He's our producer and engineer. And the devastation down there is absolutely incredible. The waterfront restaurants, hotels, living places, inland roofs and everything else, all just a mess. They are rebuilding. Some establishments have reopened, but 9 months later, it's incredible to see in person. So we get home, and then I read in the Salem News that a seawall is collapsing in Swampscott. So what's that all about?
So what you just kind of shined some light on, there's no way of understating exactly, or no way of overstating, I should say, how severe this is. I mean, you think about Hurricane Katrina and what happened in New Orleans and the fact that some portions of New Orleans, 20 years later, are still rebuilding. Mm-hmm. So it's just this stuff takes absolutely forever. But, of course, we have the story in Swampscott that played out recently where the mission on the bay almost became mission in the bay. Basically, the seawall that the restaurant rests on suffered a collapse. And I know the last I had heard, there was some question about who owned the wall and who was going to be ultimately responsible. It actually may not be a town wall. It could be up to the business to actually kind of pony up all the cash for that. But it is going to be a serious thing. And it actually, the timing of it was really interesting because about a week and a half before that, we ran a big story on seawalls in Salem and kind of the perilous nature that's facing those. And my story kind of focused on this this road that's along Juniper Cove called Columbus Avenue, where it's got like a 450-foot-long seawall that's owned by the city. And then you've got the kind of the two wings of the cove are lined with, I think, 29 different residential properties who all have their own seawall systems. And there's this question that's coming up when the city expands its seawall, increases it by 3 feet in height because of rising ocean tides and things like that. What happens to the rest of the wall? Obviously, it's not like the water's going to hit that extra tall wall and go, oh, we have to stop, let's go back. They're going to go straight to the sides and hit all the residential properties. There was one guy that I talked to who only has 90 feet of wall that he would have to work on, and it would cost him $400,000, literally the price of a condo. So it's kind of going to show just how critical these situations are, where if you can't literally basically buy a new house to stay in your house, then you've got to abandon your property because it's going to be lost one way or the other. So seawalls are kind of, a lot of people are starting to pay more attention to them, and unfortunately they just have like these absolutely crushing price tags to repair them. Salem Willows has one where the earth behind it's literally falling in, and they're going to have to put up barricades this year because they don't want little kids falling into the chasms that are being created by the ocean. I know the Derby Wharf over by the National Park Services site is looking at a multi-million dollar rebuild at some point in the next few years. And it's just every single place where the ocean hits land, there are problems being caused by it that we're all trying to catch up on before they catch up on us.
Wow. All right. So much more to the story than that headline. And I know in Gloucester they're putting up flood barriers along the canal. And
Gloucester, Rockport, Marblehead's got issues. So like any place that's got a peninsula or anything like that, you're getting hit from three sides.
Wow. All right. Well, stay. I hope you did well in your science lessons, Dustin. If not, you're learning now, I guess.
Oh yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go over back to Paul. Not really a Beverly story, but a great North Shore story on Marblehead principal Dan Bauer.
Yes. Yesterday, I attended the Anti-Defamation League of New England's annual, it's called the Essex County Law and Education Day. It was a big event held at Kernwood Country Club in Salem. There were like 350 people there, a lot of local law enforcement, officers, police chiefs, and a lot of educators, school officials, and so forth. So, and this event is designed in part to, to honor people in law enforcement and education who have helped to further the ADL's mission to combat hate and discrimination and prejudice and so forth. And anyway, Dan Bauer was honored with one of their top awards, and he's currently the principal at Marblehead High School, and he's been named the next superintendent in Danvers. He starts in that job on July 1st, and of course he was an assistant principal at Beverly High School, and I know Rick, you know him well from his days as a football coach at Beverly High School. So anyway, Dan was honored, and two students from Marblehead High, a brother and sister, actually, one is a graduate of Marblehead High School, another, the boy is a sophomore there, but they both spoke and said how Bauer has been so helpful in terms of, combating, anti-Semitic speech and hate speech and creating a culture in the school where students feel comfortable. And they both said that he's the type of guy, and I think, I know Dan a little bit, too, from his Beverly days, where he's very approachable, and he's just open and concerned about kids, and actually, their mother, the two students' mother, who's actually a chair of the ADL committee, is a, it's a parent in Marblehead, and she said that she actually went to, she was on the search committee when they were picking a principal at Marblehead High School, and they were looking at Dan Bauer, and they went to Beverly as part of the search. And she said, when she spoke to some parents in Beverly, they were actually crying because Dan Bauer was leaving Beverly. So I thought that really told how people felt about him. So it was nice to see him honored at this big event.
Well, he's made such a positive impact all over the North Shore. That is just a great story. Appreciate that one. All right, next, as we finish up, we got two stories about money, one from each of you, and I'm going to turn over to Dustin now regarding Salem State. They're raising money, and they're facing a lawsuit at the same time?
Oh, no. So there's two different things there. So Salem State University is raising money for a new campaign. It's kind of an extension of prior campaigns they've been running, but they're trying to raise $75 million. As they call it, Meet the Moment. That's the name of the campaign. And this is incorporating a number of different things in terms of trying to drive student success, trying to increase support for Hispanic and Latino and Latina students, and just basically everything along those lines. The other thing in terms of the lawsuit that you were hearing about was actually not Salem State. It was Salem Hospital.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep. Thank you. Yep.
No, it's okay. But it was, in this case, it was the family that filed a lawsuit against the hospital for what they had described as negligence by not running a couple of tests on a loved one who was going through a medical emergency at the time. And what it was an aortic aneurysm. So the lawsuit that they had filed in civil court basically said you should have done these tests, and the fact that you didn't do these tests meant that you didn't diagnose the aneurysm. The gentleman passed away, and the jury ultimately sided with them and awarded a massive, massive award to the family, mostly to two daughters of the gentleman who, you know, are, you know, they don't have that father figure in their lives anymore. So it's kind of two different stories there, but the Salem State campus, the Meet the Moment campaign was a really big thing. They invited us to the launch, and they basically took Rocket Arena and completely transformed it. And I've seen, like, John Legend play there. I saw Tom Brady answer questions there about, you know, Deflategate and things like that. And then when you walk in there and you get this, like, shining blue light, these massive drapes that are literally the size of the room. It's an arena.
Mm-hmm.
And they start talking about, you know, the money that they're trying to raise, the diversity efforts that they're pushing and things like that. And it was just a really, really big show. Kind of felt like, I honestly felt like I was sitting at Apple unveiling the next iPhone or something like that, because John Keenan's up on the stage with all the people that have spoke throughout like an hour of speeches and programming, and he kind of waves his hands in the air. You hear like these like explosion like sounds, and all of a sudden all the curtains around the room drop and unveil these things that are like showing the different programs of Salem State. And it seemed really, really profound how Salem State's kind of pushing forward, especially as colleges are seeing less and less money and less resources hitting them, to see Salem State growing, seeing increases in enrollments, and kind of working to transform a workforce that is about to get transformed by offshore wind. So
I got to ask you,
everything going on there.
As a parent, I used to bristle when I would get donation envelopes from a certain university. While I was paying this tremendous amount of money to that university for my child to go to school there. And, you know, I'm thinking, you want more money from me? But this sounds like a different thing. Who was being targeted in a fundraising campaign like this, with such big hopes?
So interestingly enough, you actually kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's absolutely previous donors and things like that. So the event that I was at was definitely tailored for VIPs and things like that, and people who were previous donors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically showing, you know, if you can support us in this campaign to get the $75 million, which, by the way, they're already halfway there. He mentioned that the previous effort to raise $25 million and everything like that has already got them to $40 million of the $75 that they're chasing. So it's just a matter of trying to get them to do exactly as you had said. You know, you supported the organization as they were supporting you in becoming from a student to a career. And, you know, now they're kind of asking their donors to kind of step forward one more time to kind of push them to the finish line here. But one of the things that they did, and this is why they had all the, you know, all the gunpowder going off and things like that, was the fact that they're going to be doing absolutely transformative things with this money if they can pull off the campaign, which every other campaign in the past they have pulled it off. So it's just a matter, I don't think it's if, it's when, really,
mm-hmm.
when they hit that $75 million point. I'm sure we'll be writing about it in a few years.
Wow, very exciting. All right, and money. Let's go over to Beverly and talk about money and the city and the airport and the FAA. What's that all about, Paul?
Yeah, so this story is that the Federal Aviation Administration and the state's, the Massachusetts Aeronautics Division wrote a letter to the city of Beverly earlier this week or last week saying, hey, you've been using a building at Beverly Airport for the last 7 years but haven't been paying rent to the airport. You need to pay rent. And so I learned a lot about this because I'm thinking, well, you know, Beverly Airport is, you know, it's a municipal airport, and who is it owned by? It's owned by the city of Beverly. And I'm like, the city of Beverly needs to pay rent on an airport they own. But it turns out that they do, that there were these, you know, Federal Aviation Administration rules that govern the use of airport land, even if it's owned by a municipality. And they have a stake, the FAA, they've been giving like an average of $1 million a year in funding to Beverly Airport over the last 25 years or so, like they do with other airports around the country. So, you know, these rules are tied to this grant funding, and their policy is that if there's a non-aeronautical use of an airport, then the airport needs to be made whole on that and paid fair market value. So that's sort of the basic policy. And the city has not been they've been using it just a small building, you know, right outside the airport. It's on airport land that they've been using for the Department of Public Services carpentry shop. And so there's been, and I spoke with Mayor Cahill, and he said that they understand that they have to, you know, have a lease agreement to use the building. It's been delayed for various reasons. There's been three different airport managers over the years, the pandemic and so forth. Anyway, those are the reasons that he gave. But the bottom line is the FAA said, you need to come up with a solution when you're within 30 days or it's going to jeopardize, you know, our funding of the airport. The airport, they're planning to do a $14 million reconstruction of one of their two runways, and the FAA would pay for most of that. So, you know, Cahill said, we're not going to let it get that far. You know, we're going to resolve this, but they're going to have to, you know, pay up or at least come up with some type of lease agreement with the airport for the use of this building.
Boy, the things you don't know, you don't know. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, Rick, no, that's the, I'm like, I had no idea about that. And just so people might be, I mean, your Beverly Airport, it's a busy airport. It's there are twice as many takeoffs and landings at that airport now than there were 7 years ago. And, Rick, I know you don't have video. I can actually give you some audio because I live near the airport, and a plane is flying overhead right now. So I don't hear that. Just to, you know, just to enhance the podcast.
Well, we were just at Panera over there in North Beverly, Bill Newell and I, and a Learjet or a Citation landed, and to see jets land in Beverly Airport, it's just incredible. Oh, my goodness.
And they've been getting big.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's incredible, and it's so busy. Gentlemen, any final thoughts? Anything you want to mention, Dustin?
If you can vote and you haven't voted yet, shame on you. Go vote on Tuesday.
All right, and Paul?
No, I would say the same thing. I mean, this is really, you know, I cover Beverly, and Dustin's been doing a great job covering the Salem race, but it's kind of a sneaky thing in terms of, you know, this is an election in May, you know, a local your mayoral election, but it's a big one. So, you know, I'm really interested in it, and I agree with Dustin. I hope people get out there and vote.
And I hope circulation goes up, too, for you guys.
Yeah, there you go.
That's awesome. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks.
You got it. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That is Paul Layton and Dustin Luca, the Salem News journalists who are with us usually twice a month. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore.